I've heard from some of you in the past that even asking your doctor for a fasting insulin, which is perhaps the single most important test that I think everyone should be getting, is denied. And I just don't understand that. On this week's podcast, I wanted to share my most recent set of blood work. I've done blood work 4 times in the last 2 years, and I haven't done it in about a year. Usually I try and do blood work every 6 months, but I missed one. So I've got a comprehensive set of blood work for you guys here. I'm going to walk you through it, tell you what I ordered, why I ordered it, how to interpret it, and how you can get your own blood work so you're not dependent on your doctor, all these kind of things. So I like showing my blood work. I think it's an opening of the kimono. It's proof is in the pudding. You get to see how healthy I am with an animal-based diet. A lot of the questions people have, a lot of the criticisms people have of eating this way are answered with labs to show that I'm healthy, that I'm doing great with this diet. So enjoy this podcast showing my most recent set of blood work. All right, guys, time to share my most recent set of blood work. I share this with you every time I get blood work. It's not meant to be overwhelming in technicalities. It's just meant to be a guide of the kind of stuff that I look for when I get my blood work. I'm getting pretty darn comprehensive blood work for myself. I don't think you need all of these things, but I do think that basically everything I'm getting in this set of blood work is valuable and helps me sort of navigate how I'm doing with my overall health. I think that if more physicians ordered blood work for their patients at the level of detail that you'll see in this presentation, I think we would see a lot of issues come up that are often missed in patients. I remember previously when I was working in hospital and outpatient clinics as a PA in cardiology, and then as a physician doing kind of lifestyle integrative medicine, it was not uncommon to see most physicians just order a CBC and a Chem7 or a CBC and a comprehensive metabolic panel for their patients. And most of the time, if you go to the doctor, that's about all they're going to check. They're going to check a CBC. They might check a comprehensive metabolic panel. They might just get a basic metabolic panel, and they'll check your cholesterol. And as you'll see, I always check far more detailed blood work than that. And I've talked about my blood work in the past. This is the 4th podcast I've done sharing my blood work. I will link in the description to the previous podcast if you really want to see all of my old blood work, but I don't think there's a real reason to. This set of blood work looks very similar, as I'll talk about throughout the presentation. This set of blood work looks pretty similar to those as I'll talk about in this podcast, but I've shared my blood work from August of 2022, November of 2022, March of 2023, and now this blood work was obtained at the end of February in 2024. I like to get blood work about every 6 months, but in this case, this full panel was about a year between the last time I got it. So let's jump in and I will show you guys my blood work. The last thing I'll say before we start looking at the blood work is that I really appreciate it when other people in the health space share their own blood work. And it's something that I see happen very rarely. In fact, I can't think of very few people in the keto space, in the low carb space that I've ever seen share their blood work. I'll talk about why in this podcast and some things that I think might not look good on your blood work if you're low carb, like thyroid or testosterone, sex hormone binding globulin, et cetera. But I would love to see some of the people who argue that a low carb diet is better than including carbohydrates in your diet share their blood work. And also I will take you through my blood work and show you why, based on this analysis, I don't think there's any evidence that eating carbohydrates in my diet in the form of fruit and honey, primarily with milk, is in any way, shape, or form harmful for me. There's really, as I said, no evidence for harm in my blood work of any of those things, despite the fact that a lot of people in the keto or carnivore space like to claim that there would be. There's absolutely no evidence in my blood work. And I would argue that this blood work that I have looks better than the blood work that I had when I was strict carnivore. I've previously done blood work going very far back into my carnivore days, and I'll talk about how all this blood work I have now looks different from that blood work throughout as we go through it. At the end of the podcast, I will summarize all the labs that I get and give you guys a list on the screen of this set of blood work if you want to order your own blood work. There are lots of ways to get your own blood work without even going to see a physician, to tell you the truth. I don't have any affiliations with these, but at the end of the podcast, I'll list some resources if you want to order your own blood work. I think it's pretty frustrating for a lot of people when they go to their doctor and they ask for blood work of this detail and their doctors won't get it. I've heard from some of you in the past that even asking your doctor for a fasting insulin, which is perhaps the single most important test that I think everyone should be getting, is denied. And I just don't understand that. So let's get into the blood work. All right, guys. So as you can see here, blood work collected 2/26/2024, 8:30 in the morning. That is a fasting blood draw. That's important that you understand that your blood work is going to look different in terms of testosterone, hormones, and cholesterol if you're fasting versus not fasting. Also, a fasting insulin is what you want. So this is fasting blood work at 8:30 in the morning. With regard to testosterone, as I'll talk about later in the podcast, you want to make sure that this is drawn as early as possible. Even if you're fasting and you get this at noon, for instance, not going to be the same. You really can't get a valid testosterone level after 9 a.m. because testosterone has a circadian rhythm and it's highest in the morning for most of us males and females that have a day shift type of work schedule or are awake during the day and sleep at night. You can see here that I'm 46 years old, soon to be 47. As I've said in the past, I have never taken TRT. I do not take TRT. I don't take steroids. I think if you look at my physique, you can tell I don't take steroids or TRT. I don't take any drugs. I don't take any herbal supplements to increase my testosterone. This is all just normal hormones. What you're seeing is just my normal physiology as a 47-year-old male. As I've spoken about on previous podcasts, I recently added a small amount of creatine to my daily regimen because I wasn't always getting 2 pounds of meat in my diet every day. And I feel like this improves my mental performance and my surfing performance. I've also recently started experimenting with methylated B vitamins. I've spoken about in the past, and I'll speak about in this podcast, the fact that I have a MTHFR polymorphism and a couple other polymorphisms within the realm of methylation, including COMT. And that I generally feel better when I have a methylated B vitamin supplement, even if I'm eating half an ounce of liver per day. For many people, a methylated B vitamin supplement may not be necessary, especially if you don't have polymorphisms at your MTHFR gene or other genes that are significant within the methylation cycle, also known as the folate cycle. But I think that that's important to understand in your physiology. And so I do think it's worth getting some sort of analysis of your genetics, looking at single nucleotide polymorphisms. And I think for most people, just half an ounce of liver per day, either fresh or desiccated, cooked, however you want to get that liver is fine. Plus some heart is going to get you a good amount of riboflavin. So those are things that I try and eat in my diet every day is about half an ounce of raw. I do raw liver. Plus I eat 3 to 4, sometimes 5 or 6 ounces of heart per day, plus grass-fed meat. I've done other podcasts talking about what I eat in a day, but I'll summarize it all at the end for you guys. So let's get into the labs with all of that further framing. The first thing you see on the blood work here is the complete blood count. This is just standard blood count. It's looking at white blood cells. It's looking at red blood cells. It tells you if you're anemic or not, if you have too few red blood cells. If your white blood cells are elevated, that's an indication of an infection. And what is the size of your red blood cells, which is the MCV. Some people who have anemia, their blood cells get small, depending on what's causing the anemia, like an iron deficiency anemia can cause your red blood cells to get small. It's called a microcytic anemia. If your red blood cells look big and you're anemic, that may be related to folate or B12. If you're eating an animal-based diet, you're not going to be deficient in vitamin B12. But if you're not getting enough egg yolks or heart plus liver, you might not be getting enough folate, especially if you're only eating animal foods. So it's important to check your folate levels in your blood, and you'll see mine later in this podcast. As you can see here, basically all of the metrics on my complete blood count are within normal. There's nothing crazy to point out here. I don't have any current infections going on, so my white blood cell count is not elevated. My red blood cell count is within normal. My hematocrit is actually pretty darn high, something that has to do with my iron levels, probably, and just the fact that I'm an athlete in the ocean all the time. I've often wondered recently with my hematocrit kind of bumping up if being in the ocean and surfing and very often having to hold my breath under waves is increasing the hematocrit, but I'll talk about the iron levels a little bit later. But my hematocrit is still within normal, though I definitely have a large oxygen carrying capacity, which I benefit from when I'm surfing and working out with a robust hematocrit. So you can see the hematocrit right there at 51. Everything else here is normal, and I won't go into tons of detail on the rest of the CBC. Enhanced grandma's memory. Check out this review on mood, memory, and brain from Chloe. My grandma struggled with Alzheimer's, so she started taking mood, memory, and brain. During the 8 months she has been taking it, her memory has become noticeably better. She is more cheery and optimistic, and she is much sharper overall. We can't recommend this supplement and this company, Heart and Soil, enough. How cool is that, guys? Mood Memory and Brain is one of my favorite products at Heart and Soil. It contains grass-fed brain, liver, and bone marrow from regeneratively raised cattle in New Zealand. Do not accept imitations, guys. The cattle in Australia and New Zealand are some of the finest, the healthiest. The grass there is so good, which is why the organs are so full of nutrients. We never put any of our products in plastic, always glass, because plastic is bullshit. There's actually really good research looking at bovine cortex-derived phosphatidylserine for cognitive decline and dementia. And wouldn't you know it, that when researchers use plant-derived phosphatidylserine, it doesn't really improve cognitive function like bovine brain cortex derived does. So there's probably other factors in the brain that are helpful for our brains. Mood Memory and Brain is one of my favorite supplements when I'm doing a lot of podcasting, when I want to be sharp for a podcast, when I'm doing research. So check this one out, guys. You can find Mood Memory and Brain and all of our supplements made from grass-fed, grass-finished, regeneratively raised organs from cattle in New Zealand, exclusively the finest cattle in the world, at heartandsoil.com. soil.co, that's .co. Our mission is to help you reclaim your birthright to radical health. I'm so proud of what Heart and Soil is doing. Check us out, guys. The next thing to look at is the Comprehensive Metabolic Panel, or the CMP. The first thing you'll see here is that my fasting glucose is 89. Remember that I eat upwards of 300 grams of carbohydrates, primarily in the form of fruit and honey every day, and my fasting glucose is still very low. Often when I get a fasting glucose, it's even lower than that. Previous blood work, it's been lower 80s, sometimes high 70s. This one was 89. But from my carnivore days, when I was strictly carnivore and keto, my fasting blood glucose was above 100. And I've seen other people in the keto and carnivore space, when they do share their blood work, note that their fasting glucose is often above 100. This is physiologic insulin resistance, and the fact that your body is always making some glucose, probably through gluconeogenesis, when you are not giving your body carbohydrates. And so even though people in the keto and carnivore space will say that eating low carb is beneficial for glucose, their fasting glucose is often quite high. Whether or not this represents a problem for humans, we're not entirely sure. And as I've said in the past, I fully respect anyone doing a keto or carnivore diet if that's what works best for you. But I will point out a few times in this podcast, looking at my blood work, where I think there are problems with that type of approach for many people in terms of steroid hormones, in terms of thyroid hormones, et cetera. So my blood glucose fasting, 89. BUN is blood urea nitrogen, which is generally a measure in most of these blood work panels of how hydrated you are, or sometimes if you're eating a lot of protein, that will be elevated. You will see that my creatinine, which is a measure of kidney function, is slightly elevated at 1.3. This is important to note for anyone who is supplementing with creatine. Creatine is a compound that your body makes, but many, many, many studies, on the order of 300 to 400 studies perhaps, with creatine show that it's beneficial to have usually a little more than your body is making. In fact, 5 grams per day for a month saturates most of us with creatine and probably has benefits in terms of explosivity at the level of your muscles, cognition, recall, mental performance, and it's been studied even in high-risk pregnancy to be beneficial, and it's pretty darn safe. Creatine essentially functions as a storage compound for a phosphorus molecule, which then gets donated to ADP or AMP, so you can make more ATP, the energy currency of the human body. So you want to be able to make energy. You want to be able to do the functions in your body that allow you to repair DNA, cellular processes that allow your machinery to work. If you want the gears and levers, your metabolic engine to work, you need ATP, and creatine serves as a repository for phosphorus, which then gets donated to the other molecules, as I mentioned, in that energy utilization and generation process. Now, when you supplement with creatine, your creatinine will go up. Creatinine is simply a proxy for kidney function, and in, quote, normal individuals who are not supplementing with creatine, eating a lot of meat, which also contains creatine, or individuals who are not overly muscular, a creatinine between, as the lab says here, 0.7 and 1.2 usually says your kidneys are functioning quite well. In an individual who is not doing any of those things, isn't super muscular, an elevated creatinine may suggest that your kidneys are not filtering that creatinine breakdown product of creatine out. But in those of us eating meat, in those of us who have more muscles, in those of us supplementing with creatine, it just means that you're making more creatinine from creatine, and creatinine itself is not harmful. But if I go to a quote, mainstream physician with a creatinine of 1.3, they're going to say, your kidneys are not functioning well. And I'll say, wait, hold on. I also got a cystatin C, which is not tied to creatinine intake, and my cystatin C level is always normal. So if you are supplementing with creatine or you're eating a lot of meat, make sure you get a cystatin C in addition to your creatinine so that your doctor doesn't freak out. But this creatinine that's 1.3 is just an indication that I'm supplementing with creatine. It doesn't say my kidneys are bad in any way, shape, or form. And as I mentioned, I did get a cystatin C in this blood work. It's on a separate set of labs, and that was totally within normal. So my kidneys work just fine. Go figure, meat isn't bad for your kidneys. We knew that. The rest of the comprehensive metabolic panel are electrolytes, quote unquote. You see sodium, potassium, chloride, calcium, et cetera. Most people are not going to have derangements in these electrolytes, though I have seen some people have their sodium dip when they're limiting salt. Salt, sodium, chloride, this is not harmful for humans. Every indigenous culture seeks out salt when they can get it and relishes it. They appreciate it. Humans need sodium to function. It's a nutrient, so don't fear salt. If you have high blood pressure, realize that's probably an indication that you have underlying insulin resistance. And if you have underlying insulin resistance, your body isn't very good at getting rid of that salt. Now, mainstream medicine likes to treat that with diuretics or beta blockers or calcium channel blockers, but none of these get to the root cause, which is usually insulin resistance with high blood pressure. And if you have high blood pressure and you limit salt, your body will kick in other hormonal mechanisms like aldosterone and other hormones that work at the level of the kidney to hold on to salt, which have potentially negative consequences. So what we know is that when you limit salt, there's an increased incidence of postural hypotension, getting dizzy when you stand up, erectile dysfunction in men, potentially increased risk of falls with postural hypotension and dizziness. So salt limitation is not something that humans should be doing. Obviously, I think there's a limit to how much salt you will want to eat, and your body will tell you this because salt will start to taste bad. If you have a taste for salt, it could be that you have adrenal issues, or it could just be that you need more salt in your diet. I don't count how much salt I put on my food. It generally goes by taste at this point. But if I had to estimate, I'm probably getting between 5 and 8 grams of salt, that is sodium chloride, which is between 2.5 and 4 grams of sodium per day in my diet. With healthy kidneys, I should be able to excrete any excess of sodium from my diet just fine. But one of the problems that I ran into on a ketogenic diet many years ago was that no matter how much salt I ate, I could not hold on to my electrolytes. I've spoken about this in the past, but this has to do with the fact that we need insulin. Insulin is a peptide hormone that is produced in your pancreas, and it gets vilified, but it's an incredibly valuable thing for humans, and it's not really the bad guy at all. Insulin is not the bad guy. What is the bad guy? Stay tuned. I'll talk about that more later in the podcast, but insulin is not something to be feared. Do not fear blood glucose spikes. These are part of normal human physiology. Now, if you get a huge blood glucose spike from eating donuts and processed sugars along with seed oils, that's a different set of physiology than if you get a moderate glucose, quote, spike. Everyone fears this term now, from eating an orange or orange juice. God forbid you drink orange juice or having honey in your raw milk. These are not pathological. And the notion that any uptick of your blood glucose is going to lead to glycation in your endothelium is just false. One of the people that I'd love to have on the podcast at some point in the future is glucose goddess Jesse Inchipe, to have a friendly debate about our differences in opinions. But I think that this fearing of glucose spikes is not good for humans. Do not fear glucose spikes, quote unquote. Obviously, if you are diabetic and your blood sugar is going to 200 or 220, you're eating the wrong foods and too much of them. For most of us, normal human physiology includes blood glucose going to 130, 140, maybe even 150 milligrams per deciliter on a daily basis when you're eating carbohydrates, and that's totally fine. That is not harmful to you. Do not fear that. And I would love to have respectful discussion with anyone who feels otherwise, because there is really no good evidence that that is a harmful thing for humans. And I think there is way too much fear around increasing your blood glucose at all these days. And as I said, when I had essentially a flat blood glucose, my baseline was higher because my fasting glucose was high 90s or above 100, and I had essentially no insulin bumps throughout the day. It was very difficult for my kidneys to hold on to electrolytes. It led to muscle cramping. It led to heart palpitations. It led to being pretty darn miserable on a ketogenic diet. And I think this happens for a lot of people. Protein is insulinogenic, but not as much as carbohydrates. So some people, perhaps, if they're eating a ton of protein per day, will get enough of an insulin spike to hold on to electrolytes. But I think a lot of people in the carbohydrate limiting communities struggle with electrolytes, and there isn't enough discussion about the fact that this is because we're really forcing our physiology into a realm that it doesn't want to be by limiting carbohydrates that much. So this is all to say, don't fear carbohydrates, and realize that if you're on a ketogenic or carnivore diet, like I once was and got a lot of benefit from it, and you're struggling with electrolyte issues, muscle cramping, supplementing with more and more salt usually isn't the answer. Just adding a moderate amount of carbohydrates based on how active you are will solve the issue. And we see that time and time again when people transition from strict carnivore diets of just animal foods to quote unquote an animal-based diet, whether it's with heart and soil through the animal-based 30 challenge or people do this on their own, they feel so much better at the level of their electrolytes because getting those insulin spikes throughout the day is normal human physiology. It doesn't lead to elevated fasting insulin or metabolic dysfunction, as you'll see later in my labs, et cetera, et cetera. So potassium is not something that many people have deranged in their physiology. And calcium in the blood is not a great indication of total calcium stores, but all of this is essentially within normal for me. I'm not really going to dwell on the protein, albumin, and globulin. That's a little too granular for this podcast. Suffice it to say they're all normal. No surprise there because I'm getting plenty of bioavailable protein from my diet. Alkaline phosphatase is also normal. I will mention that AST and ALT are indications of liver function and or liver irritation. The other one to consider is getting a GGT. I have seen some people on ketogenic and carnivore diets see their AST and ALT go up, and I don't think that should be ignored. It does suggest that the liver is working harder than it would like to be, but as you can see, my AST and ALT are totally normal. And if you're curious about my levels of visceral fat, which would be fat around my organs, including my liver, I have previously shared my results of a DEXA scan on YouTube. My visceral fat was extremely low. My body fat was 10.5%, I think, when I did it. Legitimately, 10.5% as a 46-year-old. And that's basically where my body fat always is. So in addition to sharing labs, I wish more people in the health space would also share DEXA scans just to kind of give us a baseline of where people's visceral and subcutaneous fat are. As I mentioned, you can go back and look at the YouTube video of my DEXA scan. I'll put a link to it in the description. And my visceral fat was extremely low despite eating lots of fruit and honey and lots of carbohydrates, despite what people would argue in the ketogenic or carnivore space. And my body fat was extremely low as well. 10.5% for a male at 46 is pretty darn good. My bone density was normal. My muscle mass was normal. Interestingly, in my DEXA scan, both my left leg and my left arm had about a pound less muscle than my right side. Obviously, I'm right side dominant, but that's just an aside. You can see here that my CRP, the high sensitivity CRP, which is an indication of inflammation, is 0.6, which is pretty darn low. Again, meat, fruit, honey, fruit juice, not inflammatory. I've shared many times in the past multiple studies corroborating the notion that fruit juice improves endothelial function. Fruit juice is not inflammatory. You don't need to fear these things, guys. So my CRP is 0.6. You can see here my hemoglobin A1C is 5.3. That's about where it usually is. This is an average over 90 days of my blood sugar. You can see my average blood sugar, all the spikes in the day, is 111.4 grams per deciliter. And again, my hemoglobin A1C is 5.4. In the past, when I've seen people in the ketogenic and low-carb spaces share their blood sugars and their hemoglobin A1C, the hemoglobin A1C is often higher than mine because their baseline is so much higher than mine. Even with blood sugar, quote, spikes throughout the day, my average blood sugar is 111, and I get a hemoglobin A1C of 5.3, which is totally within the safe and healthy range, despite eating 300 plus grams of carbohydrates from fruit and honey. Now, I'll just say a word about the amount of carbohydrates I eat in a day. In case you're new to this content, it's just what I do based on my activity level. I surf for 2 to 3 hours every morning. I do think that all humans benefit from some carbohydrates. Even if you're obese, even if you're diabetic, even if you're overweight, getting around 100 grams of carbohydrates a day minimum will lower stress hormones, things like cortisol, catecholamines, including epinephrine and norepinephrine, glucagon, which is persistently elevated on low carb or zero carbohydrate diets. All of these stress hormones work against your efforts toward weight loss and are essentially stress signals to the body. Do I think you need 300 grams of carbohydrates? No. I would scale above 100 based on how active you are and what your body needs, but realize that 100 grams of carbohydrates will take some of the stress hormones out of the equation, which I think will benefit you long-term as a human. No matter where you are, no matter what your goals are, you can still lose weight without being keto. And I would argue that your thyroid hormones will be higher, which will keep your basal metabolism higher and lead to better health with long-term weight loss. Different podcast, but you get the idea. Next page, you can see my thyroid panel. So we're talking about the thyroid panel now. I think that this is important to see in any type of dietary strategy that you're doing. If you're trying to lose weight and you're limiting carbohydrates or you're limiting calories, check your thyroid. So TSH here is 1.18. You want your TSH to basically be on the low side. My TSH is almost always around 1.1. The reference range on TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone, which comes from your pituitary and goes to your thyroid gland, goes up to 4.2 micro IU per ml, but the 4.2 is almost always considered to be way too high by medical providers. So if your TSH is above 2, definitely above 2.5, your brain is kind of having to send extra signals to your thyroid that it should be working. So your TSH should probably be below 2.5 minus almost always 1.1. That's consistent with what I've seen in the past. The T4 and the T3, which is a little lower in this lab, these should be within the reference range. And one of the things I see consistently in myself in the past and on people I've worked with who are doing ketogenic or carnivore diets is that the T4 and the T3 go very far down. And this is not a normal thing. Those thyroid hormones are essentially like a dial in your body's thermostat. You want your basal metabolic rate to be higher. Across species, it is very clear that a higher basal metabolic rate, higher metabolism is associated with longevity. Within a species, especially whether it's dogs or mice or humans, higher metabolic rates are associated with more longevity. And I will repeat that within species, including humans and dogs and mice, the hotter you burn, and I'll repeat that within species, including humans, dogs, and mice, the hotter the flames are, the more your engine is stoked, the higher your basal metabolic rate, the more longevity that is associated with. Consider this the next time someone in the longevity community brags about a body temperature of 96.6 or something glacially cold like that. You should be checking. I also think it's very valuable and an easy test to check your morning body temperature to get a sense of your basal metabolic rate and your metabolism overall. Mine is almost always right around 98.6, sometimes even a little higher than that. But if your basal body temperature is low and you're on keto or carnivore, or you're low carb, or you're restricting calories, or you're fasting, it's a pretty clear indication that your body is not running optimally, that your engine is not running as hot as it should be, and you want your metabolism to be high. It's associated with longevity. So don't get cold. Give your body the fuel it needs, micronutrients from meat and organs, carbohydrates that you digest well, whether it's from fruit or honey or whatever carbohydrates, even tubers, if you digest those well. If you want to eat grains, that's fine. I would just consider fermenting the grains and detoxifying the grains as much as possible. But giving your body carbohydrates from whatever source you tolerate will help give your body the signal of abundance, and you'll see it in your thyroid hormones and in your sex hormones. I'm just going to scroll down here so you can see the T3. You can see here free T3, 3.2, free T4, 1.31. So again, you want to see the full thyroid panel to know how your thermostat is doing. You want your basal metabolism to be high. That's an indication of health. What's another good metric of health and longevity? This cortisol to DHEAS ratio. It's something that I spoke about on a previous podcast with Georgi Dinkov. And you want your cortisol to be as low as possible and your DHEAS to be as high as possible. I think that if more people in the quote longevity space who are preaching fasting, caloric restriction, or carbohydrate restriction, or meat restriction, honestly shared their labs, you would see that their thyroid hormones are probably low. I know some people in the longevity space have to supplement with testosterone and androgens to even have normal sex hormones because they're calorically restricting so much. And they think that their cortisol to DHEAS ratio would be too high because the cortisol would be high and the DHEAS would be low. You can see here my cortisol is 12.5 random in the morning, and my DHEAS, that's DHEA sulfate, was 142. To give a ratio of 0.084 for my cortisol to DHEAS ratio. If you're interested in literature looking at this ratio, I'll share this study. Cortisol, DHEA sulfate, their ratio, and all-cause and cause-specific mortality in the Vietnam experience study. Basically, the authors say that this is one of the best ratios for longevity and predicting low rates of cause-specific mortality and all-cause mortality, and yet I haven't heard anyone in the longevity space be willing to share theirs or talk about this ratio. So if you want to live a long time, keep your cortisol low and your DHEAS, which is an androgen, DHEA is dehydroepiandrosterone sulfate, keep that as high as possible. How do you do that? Well, you need to eat carbohydrates to do that because carbohydrates are a signal of abundance. Obviously, the quality of those carbohydrates matter. You need to give your body nutrients from meat and organs. You need to sleep, you need to get sun, and you need to have a slow stress life. I think the one piece of this that gets left out of a lot of people's equations is the sleep piece. If you're not sleeping enough or you're not sleeping well, your cortisol is definitely going to be higher. If you're not eating carbohydrates, your cortisol is going to be higher, along with the glucagon and the epinephrine and the norepinephrine. And it's very well accepted that cortisol is an aging hormone. So a lot of the interventions that people in longevity space recommend, whether it's caloric restriction or fasting, limitation of meat, limitation of carbohydrates, these all increase cortisol. Cortisol is a stress hormone. It's an aging hormone for humans. Cortisol to DHEAS ratio is going to be higher. All of those point toward increased aging, worse longevity, and yet they're in vogue today. So do the opposite of those things. Sleep, get in the sun, eat meat, don't fear carbohydrates, especially from fruit or honey, raw milk, or whatever source of carbohydrates you tolerate. Maybe don't overstress yourself in the cold plunge, guys. And maybe don't overstress yourself in the sauna either, but that's a subject for a different podcast. I'll just point out here, according to the authors, a higher cortisol to DHEAS ratio was related to an increased risk of death by other causes in the age-adjusted model. The hazard ratio was 3.11. That's a pretty significant. That's like three times higher risk with an increased higher cortisol to DHEAS ratio. You want to know what your cortisol to DHEAS ratio is, and you want to keep it as low as possible, which means giving your body signals of abundance. Things like meat, things like carbohydrates, things like sleep, things like sunlight, giving your body food throughout the day, not fasting. I'm not a fan of fasting. I've spoken about that in the past. and not restricting calories. Obviously, some people will say, how am I going to lose weight if I don't restrict calories? And I will say this. The important thing to consider here is that if you want to lose weight, applying moderation and discipline is going to be necessary. But I think applying moderation and discipline to the amount of food you eat or when you eat it is the wrong use of your efforts. Apply that moderation and discipline to the quality of the food you eat. I think that there is no better way to long-term health and sustainable weight loss than to improve your food quality. What is improved food quality, Paul? It's things that your great-great-great-grandmother would recognize as unprocessed meat and plant foods as you can eat. That is high-quality food. The more high-quality food you eat, the more full you will be, the easier it will be to lose weight. That is the way to sustainable weight loss. Counting calories, over-fasting, over-stressing your body, again, elevates all the stress hormones. That will lead to problems long-term. Let's keep going on the blood work here. We'll get to the cholesterol panel. I think this is probably what you guys were all waiting for. Lineage Me Sticks are here, guys. In case you've been living under a rock and you didn't know, I built a new company with my buddy Anthony Gustin, and our first product are these grass-fed, grass-finished meat sticks with organs. I strongly believe, I will stand behind this statement, these are the finest meat sticks in the world, on the planet. Check this out, guys. I will show you what they look like. That is a Lineage Meat Stick, the best in the world. Grass-fed, grass-finished beef, regeneratively raised, liver, heart, vinegar, salt, and a collagen casing. That's it. No lactic acid, no celery salt, no nitrates, no preservatives. Our meat sticks are air-dried. This is air-dried for 5 days at 78 degrees Fahrenheit, which preserves so many of the nutrients in here. It's essentially like a jerky, but it tastes like a meat stick. It's incredible, guys. These are going to blow your mind. Good for snacks, on the go, pre-workout, post-workout. Look, a steak, a burger, fresh meat, that's the best thing. But there's a lot of times in my life that I've really grown to appreciate a convenient snack for friends, when I'm out traveling around, in transit, for my sister, for a niece and nephew, for kids. Check us out, guys, lineageprovisions.com, finest on the planet. You're going to love them. If you don't, you can get your money back, but check us out. And we've got all kinds of exciting stuff coming for you guys. This is our first product. Stay tuned for our next suite of products, which is coming in May, but check us out, lineageprovisions.com. Let us know what you think. The reviews are in. People love these things. I want to hear what you guys think. Let us know what flavors you want next and what products you want us to make next. But these are the best meat sticks on the planet, guys. Lineageprovisions.com. See you there. And drum roll, please. My total cholesterol, 222. Triglycerides, 89. HDL, 53. This is where these usually are in the last couple of years since I've been doing an animal-based diet. You can see my LDL is 151, and in case you're wondering, my ApoB is 129. Now, let me talk about why I don't think this is a problem. When I was a strict carnivore, my LDL cholesterol was above 300, and my good friend Dave Feldman, who I've had on the podcast, has done some research with something he calls the lipid energy model. I think there's a good amount of evidence to suggest that if you are keto or carnivore, if you are limiting carbohydrates, for many people, their bodies will use the substrate found in LDL lipoprotein particle for energy, which means that if you are limiting carbohydrates, your LDL may be higher. When I included carbohydrates in my diet again, my LDL went down significantly from 350 to around 150 every time I check. Give or take, my LDL is usually around 150. I've had it as low as 130 and as high as 160 milligrams per deciliter, but that's where my LDL is when I am eating enough carbohydrates, down from 350. And the other thing that I think to consider is that if you are not eating enough carbohydrates, if your thyroid is not functioning properly, that can lead to problems with LDL metabolism as well. So lipid energy model plus minus is your thyroid normal if you're keto. Another thing to consider here is that there's a clear relationship between the ratio of saturated to polyunsaturated plus monounsaturated fats in your diet and your LDL cholesterol. What do I mean by this? The more saturated fat that I eat and the less polyunsaturated fat that I eat, the higher my LDL cholesterol is going to be. I could lower my LDL cholesterol easily by adding corn or canola or soybean oil to my food. I could lower my LDL cholesterol easily by not using butter or tallow, fats that I believe are very healthy, and by only using olive oil, a fat that is, I would say, clearly inferior to animal fat for a variety of reasons, including the fact that it's often tainted with seed oils. It's very low quality in many cases, like I said, tainted with seed oils, oxidized, etc. I don't think olive oil is the worst thing in the world. It's better than seed oils because it's not refined, bleached, and deodorized. But there's a clear relationship here, and it's that the more saturated fat that I eat, my LDL goes up maybe 10 to 15% when I'm eating max saturated fat in my diet. And this is just normal human physiology. There's something called a homeoviscous model of adaptation that I won't get into in this podcast, but I believe that the membranes of our cells probably shift in relationship to our fat composition. And when we're eating more saturated fat, the body has to make changes in the membranes to keep them at a certain level of fluidity. And that requires LDL to go up a little bit to move cholesterol into the membranes of our cells. Now, consider this. There are many, many examples of people with cholesterol levels that are essentially equivalent to mine living in the natural world that don't have rates of heart disease that are high at all. In fact, they have vanishingly small amounts of cardiovascular disease with levels of LDL cholesterol that are essentially equivalent or even higher than mine. Who am I talking about? There's been a number of studies on people living in the Polynesian atolls, and you'll love the names here, the Tokelauans and the Pukapukans. And what we find is that the Tokelauans, these people are essentially neighbors in the Polynesian atolls. The Tokelauans eat significantly more saturated fat, predominantly from coconuts, than the Pukapukans. Not surprisingly, their LDL and total cholesterols are about 20 to 30 milligrams per deciliter higher, but they don't have more heart disease than the Pukapukans. In fact, both the Pukapukans and the Tokelauans have vanishingly low rates of heart disease. Imagine that, not related to the amount of LDL or total cholesterol in their bodies, probably because they're insulin sensitive, because they're not eating a bunch of seed oils and other garbage processed foods. I'll show you guys the study. Cholesterol, coconuts, and diet on Polynesian atolls, a natural experiment, the Pukapuka and Tokelau Island Studies. Primary author here is Ian Pryor. You can see here that even in the abstract, they say that the serum cholesterol levels are 35 to 40 milligrams higher in Tokelauans than Pukapukans. Both of these populations have vanishingly low rates of vascular disease, cardiovascular disease, heart attacks, strokes, etc. If you look at the anthropometric data on them, they are all quite lean. These people are not obese. You can see the actual cholesterol levels here in table 2. And you can see that the Pukapukans versus the Tokelauans, there's a real difference here. So look at males aged 45 to 54. Mean total cholesterol is 220 milligrams per deciliter. That's exactly what mine is. And the Pukapukans are a little lower because they don't eat as many coconuts. They don't eat as much saturated fat. They're 178, but the Tokelauans with their higher cholesterol don't have higher rates of cardiovascular disease. Look at the females. Females 45 to 54, again, total cholesterol 220. 55 to 64, total cholesterol 245 in the female Tokelauans. And again, vanishingly low rates of cardiovascular disease. We see something very similar in Catawba. Primary author here is Stefan Lindeberg. Again, very healthy people, low, vanishingly low incidence of cardiovascular disease markers, high blood pressure, et cetera. And they are essentially free from cardiovascular disease and stroke, as he says in the title of the paper. If you look at the cholesterol levels here, you can see that females in Catawba, the total cholesterol 40 to 59 years old is 6.4 millimole per liter, which is around 245 milligrams per deciliter. That's higher than mine. The LDL cholesterol of the females is 4.6 millimole, which is 175, again, higher than mine. So there's plenty of evidence of free living populations of humans that consume significant amounts of saturated fat. We see their cholesterol go, quote, up with no increase in cardiovascular disease. I've done multiple podcasts on cholesterol. If you have questions about cholesterol, why I don't believe that higher LDL always leads to an increase in cardiovascular risk, why I believe there must be a contextualization here, including the insulin sensitivity. And what we see in humans who are insulin sensitive is that the relationship between LDL cholesterol and or ApoB and cardiovascular disease essentially vanishes. In some studies like the Framingham cohort, there is a very weak connection between LDL and cardiovascular disease, even in the most insulin-sensitive people, but it is much, much lower than what happens in people who are insulin-resistant. So clearly, insulin resistance is driving the majority of the connection between LDL cholesterol and cardiovascular disease. Any residual association between LDL cholesterol and cardiovascular disease can be driven by all sorts of other factors that are not accounted for by insulin sensitivity that can damage the endothelium, one of the primary inciting events of cardiovascular disease. I would argue things like smoking, things like toxins in the environment, diesel smoke, etc. There are so many things that can damage the endothelium, and I believe ApoB is not one of them, unless that ApoB is oxidized. So circle back a moment to where I talked about the fact that eating more saturated fat, my LDL goes up. Well, we know from studies that when you decrease the saturated fat in your diet and you increase the polyunsaturated fats from seed oils, your LDL may go down, but your oxidized LDL and your LP little a, a marker that I'll show you in my labs in a moment, will go up. So even though seed oils and potentially even monounsaturated fats from olive oil, though that's unclear, will lower your cholesterol, your ApoB, and your LDL, they almost certainly increase the susceptibility of your LDL to oxidation. That has been shown in multiple randomized controlled trials that I've spoken about in the past with regard to seed oils. So your LDL and ApoB levels must be taken in context. And there's good evidence that if your LDL is oxidized and it's more susceptible to oxidation when you're eating seed oils, that potentially may affect your endothelium negatively. But in someone who is metabolically healthy with an LDL slash ApoB particle that is more resistant to oxidation because more of that LDL particle is full of saturated fats from your diet that are vilified, that is not necessarily going to be harmful for your endothelium. And we see that over and over in the research. And I think that is what is getting missed by so many in the space who are telling you to lower your ApoB at all costs. What costs? Well, PCSK9 inhibitors, statins. If your LDL is elevated, you should be on a statin, right? And statins don't have many side effects, right? Except that, I mean, look at this trial from 2012 when patients with Alzheimer's, dementia, were on statins and the statins were withdrawn, their cognition got better. And the cognition got worse when they went back on the statin. So if you think a statin is a benign drug, you haven't talked to someone that's been on a statin, and maybe you're not on a statin. Because when I worked with patients in cardiology, so many patients, way more than the drug companies would lead you to believe, had muscle aches, erectile dysfunction, sexual dysfunction, memory problems. These are not benign drugs, and that's not surprising because if you inhibit the production of cholesterol, a valuable compound in our body to make cell membranes, you're also inhibiting the production of things like coenzyme Q10, involved in the electron transport chain in mitochondria, and squalene, other valuable molecules for humans. Those are difficult to replace in their entirety. Statins are not benign drugs. There are better ways to lower your cardiovascular risk. Consider also that, as according to this study from 2007, in 400 healthy term infants, 200 in the breastfeeding group, levels of cholesterol between 14 weeks and 6 months were pretty close to where mine were, 205 milligrams per deciliter. So when people are suggesting that neonatal levels of cholesterol are lower than adult levels, I don't really understand that because this is healthy for babies when they're breastfed by their mothers, levels of cholesterol that are 205 milligrams per deciliter, but that's not healthy for an adult human. These babies are developing atherosclerosis when they're being breastfed. Less than 6 months old, we're just killing our children by allowing them to have LDL cholesterol, a substance that should be completely eliminated from humans. Obviously, I'm being facetious. This line of thinking is ludicrous. But I fear that some people in the space would have us give PCSK9 inhibitors like Repatha to infants these days because no one should have an LDL cholesterol or an ApoB above 100, not even an infant, right? It's killing them. Obviously, there's something wrong with this picture, guys. Consider this study as well, total cholesterol and all-cause mortality by sex and age, a prospective cohort study of 12.8 million adults. What was the optimal level of total cholesterol for longevity? Oh, not surprisingly, it was between 210 and 240 milligrams per deciliter, right where mine is, eating a diet rich in saturated fat, consistent with where our ancestors have been. As you can see here, the hazard ratio of all-cause mortality goes up when your cholesterol is less than 210, probably related to the fact that we know that low cholesterols are associated with cancers. Now, what direction that level of causality goes is questionable, but probably when you have cancer, your cholesterol goes down. So we can't say that low cholesterol causes cancer, but the high end of cholesterol and mortality is probably related to people who are insulin resistant. But it's interesting that 210 to 240 milligrams per deciliter is the optimal range of cholesterol for all-cause mortality. How come that never gets talked about in these longevity circles of people who are telling you to lower your ApoB as much as possible? I don't get it. And the last piece of literature I'll share regarding LDL cholesterol is this study from 2023 in Circulation. Low-density lipoprotein cholesterol is predominantly associated with atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease events in patients with evidence of coronary atherosclerosis. This is the Western Denmark Heart Registry. 23,132 consecutive patients had CTA, which is computed tomography angiography, or CAC scans, which is coronary artery calcium scans. And what they found was that In patients that had a zero CAC score, so no calcified plaque in their arteries, there was no relationship between LDL cholesterol and future cardiovascular risk. Yes, that's what I said, that in this registry of 23,000 people, if you had a zero CAC score, there's no relationship between LDL cholesterol levels and cardiovascular disease risk, suggesting that in people who have a zero CAC score, they're doing things right, they're probably metabolically healthy. It didn't matter in this group what their LDL was in terms of their cardiovascular risk. It didn't matter. In people who had a positive CAC, people that already had the cat out of the bag, people that are probably insulin resistant already, those people did see a relationship between LDL and cardiovascular disease. So the clear path forward here is get insulin sensitive. You want to be metabolically healthy. Focus on that rather than lowering your LDL. That's the most important piece of this equation. Metabolic health, insulin resistance, this is the crux upon which LDL and cardiovascular risk is based. If you are metabolically healthy, the connection, the association, the correlation between LDL and cardiovascular disease is massively attenuated. And I would argue in most people, there's a very, very low risk or not even a risk at all, like they saw in the study here of 23,000 people in Denmark. So the most important thing is not to obsess over your LDL. The most important thing is to obsess over your metabolic health. How do you get metabolically healthy? I believe the best way to get metabolically healthy is to improve the quality of your food, cut out the garbage, cut out the seed oils, cut out the high fructose corn syrup, cut out the processed food. That will lead to healthy weight loss long-term and improve metabolic health. And that is the crux of the LDL versus cardiovascular disease equation. We'll keep going in my labs here and wrap this up. You can see that my vitamin D is 80. I do not supplement with vitamin D. I just live near the equator in Costa Rica. I talked about my ApoB is 129. Homocysteine relates to my methylation, and I have since started taking a methylated B vitamin. Since I got this, I would like to see my homocysteine less than 10, probably less than 8, so I'll share that the next time I get blood work. My fasting insulin is, drumroll, 3.6 micro IU per ml, and I eat 300 to 400 grams of carbohydrates a day. So tell me again that LDL causes cardiovascular disease after our last discussion, and tell me again that sugar will make me insulin resistant, because pretty darn insulin sensitive here. Uric acid is something else that people worry about with regard to fructose or carbohydrates in the form of honey. My uric acid is 4.3, totally normal. Carbohydrates like fructose do not cause gout in and of themselves. Insulin resistance is again the driver of your gout. Fruit didn't cause your gout, insulin resistance did. I eat tons of fruit juice, tons of honey, and my uric acid is 4.3. I need to get David Perlmutter on here and argue with him about that respectfully. Ferritin is 69. That's a storage form of iron. I'll come back to that in a moment. Let's get into my hormones. FSH, 4.2. My prolactin, 7.89. You want your prolactin to be as on the low side. A high prolactin indicates there's either something going on in your brain, like an adenoma or excess estrogen. We talked about my free T3 and free T4 earlier. You see my dihydrotestosterone, something I always get, is 430. Again, no TRT here. Luteinizing hormone is 7.33. Total testosterone is, I know you guys all want to see this, 814. Free testosterone, 12.5. Bioavailable, 320. I talked about my DHEAS earlier. So I am a 46-year-old male on no TRT, have never taken it. Total testosterone, 814. If I were taking TRT, my LH and FSH would be depressed. That's how it works. If you're taking exogenous testosterone, your pituitary gland stops telling your testicles to make it. My LH and FSH are totally within normal. Greg Doucette thought that based on my last set of labs, I was taking clomiphene, but I can say very clearly I am not taking clomiphene. And I told Greg that I'd be willing to take a random blood test for clomiphene anytime. And when it's negative, he owes me a ribeye steak. I'm not taking anything for my testosterone, guys. And it's normal for a 46-year-old male to have a testosterone of 800 plus. If your testosterone is low, think about nutrients, think about sleep, think about seed oils, think about all kinds of things. I've done a whole podcast on that in the past. I mentioned B12 and folate earlier. It always bugs me that on blood work, they say folic acid when in fact there's no folic acid in the human body. This should say folate. Folic acid is something you should root out of your life. Do not take supplements or any sort of compound, vitamins, et cetera, that have folic acid. There's good research to suggest that your body can't convert folic acid into the usable form, dihydrofolate or tetrahydrofolate, very well. Unmetabolized folic acid floating around in your body or your family's body is potentially problematic for humans. So this should say folate. My folate is above 20. No surprise there. I'm taking a methylated B vitamin and I eat lots of liver and heart. Again, my B12 is quite high because I'm eating animal foods. Go figure. B12 is also associated with longevity, and even vegans in the longevity community will supplement B12. Probably could just eat some meat. So that's most of my hormones. Again, I will say that I think that it is totally possible for a nearly 50-year-old male to have a robust testosterone if you are living your life well, if you're sleeping, if you're getting nutrients, if you're not overstressing yourself. My testosterone is great, and I feel good in terms of libido, especially when I prioritize my sleep. Last but not least, I mentioned the lipoprotein little a, LP little a, it's 13.1. As I mentioned earlier, if you're eating seed oils or excess polyunsaturated fats, your ApoB and your LDL may go down, but your LP little a and your oxidized LDL will go up. LP little a is essentially a scavenger molecule for oxidized cholesterol. Those going up will increase your cardiovascular risk significantly. That is not something you want. Seed oils are clearly harmful for humans. If you don't know, now you know. My iron panel is here. It's something I've talked about in the past. You can see here that my iron saturation is 62% and my hematocrit earlier was 51. I don't have hemochromatosis, which is a congenital condition where you absorb and hold on to excess iron. You store a lot of iron. It leads to essentially a bronze diabetes where your skin can become dark. You become diabetic because your pancreas is damaged from all the excess iron. I don't have that. We saw that my ferritin was within normal and on the, in fact, low side. I've been doing regular phlebotomy, but I do hold on to and store iron pretty avidly. So I just think about my iron levels and I've started doing therapeutic phlebotomy. I feel better when I'm doing that. You can see my iron is all within normal. And just that percent saturation is high, probably an indication again that I hold on to iron very avidly. If you're a male especially, you should know what's going on with your iron levels. I don't make any medical recommendations on the podcast, but I think that a lot of us males would feel better if our ferritin levels were less than 100. And doing regular phlebotomy has helped me get mine from as high as 332 down to now 69. It's been even lower than that at 50 or 30s in the past. The one thing that I skipped over with my hormones is sex hormone binding globulin. You can see my SHBG is 57. And when I was doing keto, my SHBG was 125. And my SHBG was also higher when my iron was higher. So doing phlebotomy and adding carbohydrates to my diet has lowered my sex hormone binding globulin significantly, which allows more free testosterone to circulate. Free testosterone is valuable and is also something that leads to the effects of the level of the receptor in the nucleus. So you want more free testosterone. You don't want your SHBG to be high. Again, yet one more thing that I think people should be sharing in the keto and carnivore and low carb spaces so we can understand that when you limit carbohydrates, it can have negative effects on your sex hormones. When I was a strict carnivore, my total testosterone went below 500. And again, now, every time I check it, it's around 800, depending on how I've slept. So that is essentially all of my blood work. I went through it all, showed you guys all of it. If you want to recreate this blood work, I'll put a list of all the blood work I just shared with you on the screen in terms of the actual things to get. You want to get a CBC with differential. You want to get a comprehensive metabolic panel. You want to get a fasting insulin. You want to get a homocysteine. You want to get folate, B12, a full thyroid panel, including free T3, free T4, even a reverse T3 would be helpful. You want to make sure you're getting a full hormonal panel with testosterone, estradiol, progesterone, prolactin, LH, FSH, SHBG. You want to look at hsCRP. You want to look at homocysteine. You want to get a full iron panel. You want to look at cortisol. You want to look at DHEAS. You want to make sure you check vitamin B12, folic acid, which is actually folate, but the labs will say it's folic acid. Check a prolactin, check a uric acid. 25-hydroxy vitamin D is the test you want to see for your vitamin D. Hemoglobin A1C. And if you are taking creatine, you want to make sure you get a cystatin C to look at your kidney function because your doctor will freak out because your creatinine may be a little high. I do not think you need an NMR lipid panel. If you want to get an NMR or a lipoprotein lipid panel that's more sophisticated, you can do that. I've shown my blood work with that in the past. I think getting a basic lipid panel with an ApoB is fine. Again, interpret that in the context of insulin sensitivity. Know what your fasting insulin is. So that's all my blood work, guys. Hopefully that's helpful. I know it's a lot of technicalities, but I think that when I look at this blood work, I think, okay, things are going great. My energy is good. My libido is good. My sleep is good. My mood is good. My recovery is good. I have good performance in the ocean surfing. I'm insulin sensitive. I'm not anemic. My fasting blood sugar is normal. My fasting insulin is normal. My testosterone is good. I don't have evidence of liver inflammation. My overall inflammation is very low. I don't have elevated uric acid. My kidneys look great. My liver looks great. Eating an animal-based diet of a significant amount of animal products, whether it's raw dairy, raw cheese, raw butter, plus grass-fed beef, plus organs, either fresh or desiccated, like we make at Heart and Soil. Been eating some Lineage sticks recently. If you don't know about Lineage, it's our new meat stick with heart and liver, plus fruit. I scale the carbohydrates based on how active I am. I eat all sorts of fruit. I eat fruit juice. I eat honey or maple syrup in my raw dairy. That's essentially my diet. And if you listen to previous podcasts, I experimented with some sources of complex carbohydrates, but I generally don't eat many complex carbohydrates. If you feel better with complex carbohydrates, be it rice or potatoes, just understand that some people don't do great with those. Rice seemed to give me brain fog no matter what I did with rice. Potatoes I can tolerate every once in a while, especially if I pressure cook some white potatoes that I've taken the skin off. But generally, I just feel better with simple carbohydrates, but do what works for you. I think some people do good with tubers like sweet potato. Some people can probably do fine with oatmeal, even though I've talked in the past about why I'm not a fan of oatmeal. Saponins, pesticides, heavy metals, phytic acid. There are ways to make oatmeal more digestible for humans. You have to ferment it. You have to put it in warm water with an acidic substance, whether it's whey or lemon juice, maybe some raw milk for multiple days. But that will significantly decrease many of the problems with oatmeal. It won't get rid of the heavy metals and it won't get rid of the saponins, but it will get rid of the phytic acid. So I think there are some people who can do grains. If you want to ferment your own sourdough, be my guest. Sourdough is delicious. It doesn't make me feel great, but there are ways to detoxify grains. It's just that many of the grains as sources of carbohydrates, I think, present more problems for humans because they require more preparation and, quote, detoxification. So humans can eat these grains, but some people do better without them. And a lot of us don't have the time or desire to spend days fermenting rice or wheat. If you're into that, great. That makes it much better for humans. But in general, if you just take oats out of the package and cook them, especially if they're not organic, all sorts of problems. Same with wheat, same with rice. You've got to really prepare the grains if you're going to use grains as a carbohydrate source. So hopefully that's helpful, guys. I would challenge people in the health space in general, whether these are people in the ketogenic space, the low-carb space, the carnivore space. Just, I think health influencers in general should share their blood work more so we can see what's going on under people's hoods, so to speak, and know that the people that we're listening to are actually healthy and doing what they say. I wish more health influencers shared their DEXA scans so we could see their fat and their visceral fat, and we would see how healthy a lot of the people we listen to actually are. So that's why I do it. It's an opening of the kimono, and I think that I'm open to any feedback on it. If you guys don't think it looks good, let me know, but I think that from what I'm seeing, it looks just fine, and I think it allays a lot of concerns people have and a lot of confusion about what the diet that I'm eating will do to humans can be cleared up by just showing the actual brass tacks of the blood work. So a lot of you guys have been asking for it. There it is. See you in the next podcast. If this is valuable for you, please like and subscribe. Share it with people who think you would benefit from seeing my blood work to prove what I'm talking about and to corroborate all of the assertions I make about this way of eating and how humans become healthy and free from disease. Later, guys. In this podcast, I told you guys I was going to share where you can get your own blood work. I have no affiliation, but I used ultalabs.com, ULTA. You can order all of your own stuff on there. This is not a cheap set of blood work, but that's what I did. Again, no affiliation with those guys, but it seemed like it was pretty easy to use them. And that's how I got my blood work. There are a couple other services online. WellnessFX closed down. It's not there anymore. But if you want to get your own blood work, check out Ulta. No affiliation. Just, I think it's good to not have to rely on your doctor to get your blood work. All right, guys, that's it.